Paul is on the way to see the governor. Anybody remember who the governor was? It was
Felix.
All right, it was Felix. And anybody know who replaces Felix a little later? His name also begins with an F. We move from Felix to... All right, very good. It's going to be Festus. How many troops approximately were used to get Paul safely to the governor's residence?
400.
All right, we've got about 470 troops. We're just under 500 people. And as we look at the end of Acts chapter 23, we'll start with 31 and read down through 35 and just offer a quick summation. So the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipateris. We said that that was kind of a military fortress. It was a Roman colony. But on the morrow, they left the horsemen to go with them and return to the castle. So 470 people, as far as soldiers, 70 on horse are going to continue to escort Paul. The other 400, they go back. This was a pretty quick march when you look at the amount of distance traveled and the time traveled. All right, then in 33, and they, when they came to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, presented Paul also before him. And when he had read it, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, he said, I will hear thee fully when thine accusers who are come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's palace. It does not seem, and I think this is kind of an interesting detail, it does not seem like there was a lot of time between Paul getting to Caesarea and the letter being brought to the governor. Today, if you were to show up at the governor's office, just being able to walk into the office and say, we have this case or there's this problem we want you to take a look at, that probably wouldn't go over too well. They'd probably say, you're going to have to make an appointment. We can maybe schedule you in a couple weeks, or maybe we can get you in a couple months, whatever it might be. But in this particular case, Paul almost seems to move to the front of the line. Now, here's the other thing. If you're in Caesarea, you're living there. Obviously, you know, it'd be like living in a place where you have the state capital and you've got the governor in your community. Would there be times maybe where you would sort of pay attention and say, wonder what's going on there? Think about our state. You're living in the capital city. Might ever be a time where people who live in that place, they see all kinds of things on a regular basis, might be any set of circumstances where they say, huh, I bet something special is going on today.
Right.
Huh? Why? What do they see?
Something unusual.
Okay, that's true. Let's see if we can be a little more specific. What might they see?
Soldiers.
All right. You see a bunch of soldiers. You see the army convoy. And you're thinking, all right, something's going on. Maybe it's the guard, or maybe there's some kind of, or you got the jets flying overhead. If you've got 70 horsemen riding into town, you think that would be a little unusual? I think people would, you know, I wonder who that guy is. And you might not think bad things. I mean, you probably wouldn't anticipate that as far as a prisoner. You might be thinking, hey, who do they have with them? All right, somebody important, maybe somebody who's going to be honored. This is going to be something significant. And then we talked about why Felix asked concerning the province, noted that Pilate tried something similar with Jesus. Anything that you want to add or ask over Acts chapter 23? Having closed off the chapter, let's now move into Acts chapter 24 and verse 1. And after 5 days, 5 days passed, the high priest Ananias came down with certain elders and with an orator, one Tertullus, and they informed the governor against Paul. Paul's accusers come. 5 days have passed. You can go back to Acts chapter 23 and verse 35 for a cross-reference. Now, that was either 5 days after Paul left Caesarea, or that was 5 days after, or left Jerusalem, rather, after 5 days that he arrived in Caesarea. We do, I think, have the information here, sufficient material to conclude that it was a top-notch legal team. Sometimes when you talk to people, if they've been incarcerated, they would say, I can't afford a lawyer, and they've given me a public defender. I've talked to some people over the years who had public defenders, and I have yet to find anybody who has really been satisfied with that type of representation. I mean, it might be free, but sometimes the old adage, you get what you pay for, is very true, and that has often been the case with many who have gone through our legal system. Who is sort of the top dog as far as Paul's accusers? All right, we've got Ananias, who is going to be the Jewish High priest. So he certainly would have been a heavy hitter. And then who else do we have?
Elders.
All right, we've got the orator. We're going to talk a little bit more about him. And then we've got the elders. So we wouldn't imagine that all the elders came, but once again, you might be thinking, if we're going to go before the governor, let's have a choice group of people. Anybody remember the O.J. Simpson Dream Team? Any names come to mind as far as who was on the Dream Team? Yes, we had Marcia. She was on the prosecution side. Yes, I was hoping somebody would come up with him. Right, I think he's deceased now, but Johnny Cochran. There were some names where, and that's why they called it the Dream Team. If you have enough money, have enough connections, you can bring in some top-notch legal people, either to prosecute or to hopefully defend you successfully. And here we have this fellow, Tertullus. He was an orator, which I think we need to understand it that way. He was very skilled as far as his verbal presentation. But also the word can be used in a narrower sense, and that would be describing legal counsel. So I'm kind of thinking he helped in two different ways. He was qualified as far as representation, or in this case prosecution. He could take care of the legal aspect, and then you have some orators. Anybody ever been on a jury trial? All right. If maybe you've been on, I've been on two. And when you walk in there, I remember from my first one, I was kind of thinking, hey, we're going to see the Perry Masons in action. Anybody see Perry Mason in action when you went for your jury trial? I didn't. I mean, I remember one, I was thinking, if you're paying for this guy, I'd get somebody else. I mean, if you're going to defend me, I want you to be the bulldog. I want you to go out and, I mean, go get him, you know, defend me, give me a robust defense, tell him I'm innocent, which, you know, hopefully that would be the case, but I want you to stand up for me. And this other guy, you know, I'd written a couple things to the judge and the defense lawyer, which I thought would have been really, really helpful as far as questions to have asked and answered, but I still remember the defense lawyer shaking his head, we're not going to ask that. And I thought, you just sort of sunk your client, buddy. So anyway, people have not always gotten good representation, but this fellow seems like he was really top-drawer help. One source they give you this quote said, there were a class of men, representatives of whom could be found in most every province in the empire, who for a fee would present the case of a plaintiff or defendant, they could go either way, by bringing to bear on the court the knowledge of Roman law, and especially by using their glib eloquence in an attempt to influence a judge. And that is exactly what we have going on here. Judging from the way he speaks, he was not himself a Jew. More likely, he was a Greek or a Roman. And you would imagine that if you are this angry, this upset with Paul, remember the Jewish mob that was beating on him, they wanted to kill him? If you want to shut this guy down, you're not going to go for the cheapest. You're not going to go for the guy who just happens to be available. You're probably going to want the best guy. So whether they bring this guy from the area of Jerusalem, I mean, it does seem like it when you look at 24 and verse 1, and with an orator, with is in parentheses in the ASV. It's possible that they found him in Caesarea. I don't think, though, that is very likely. The Sanhedrin had already had an opportunity, Acts chapter 23 and verse 30, to charge Paul with a crime. They failed. Paul kind of messed that up when he divided the assembly. But I would imagine that these fellas, they got their team together, they've had a few days to think through things, and it's like anything else. If you have time to think about how you're going to argue your case, you're probably going to be a lot more successful rather than just cold turkey. It's probably going to go a lot better if you can think about it in advance. Anything that you want to add or ask or discuss before we look at verses 2 and 3 in Acts 24? Okay. And when it was called, Tertullus began to accuse him, that would be Paul, saying, seeing that by thee, that would be the governor, Felix, we enjoy how much peace?
Great.
We enjoy much peace. We enjoy great peace. And that by whose providence? The governor, his work. What happens when it comes to the evil in the nation? It's let go, or he deals with it. All right, he says the evils are corrected for the nation. We accept it in all ways and in all places, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. All right, so the orator, he is up first. He's going to present the case. He's going to lay out the accusation against Paul. But before he does that, how does he address the governor? Yes, he does. Now, in fairness to this fella, if you go back and you look at some ancient literature, this was not uncommon. I mean, this was not exceptional. This was just the way that they acted. They buttered him up. And if you have ever written to a congressperson or you've ever written to the president, at least in the past, if you checked out some of the form letters, some of the suggested, you know, dear honorable, you know, and you have a few things in there that just splash around as far as the person's title or the person's role. So he begins, the orator tells Felix that he had made life really more enjoyable for people. Well, if you're the governor, you know, President Biden is taking a lot of flack right now from a lot of sides. And if you were President Biden, how would you like to get the daily news? I mean, you pick up the newspaper and this paper's bashing you and that paper is bashing you, and then you turn on talk radio or you turn on the TV and they're talking about how people feel like you're doing such a rotten job. How would you feel?
Disheartened.
Well, you wouldn't want to hear the news. You would feel disheartened. You want to turn on the news and have people say, we're doing great, the economy's wonderful, we appreciate your policies. And if it's not going that way, if people are not getting that kind of feedback, it is disheartening. But here the governor is told that he had offered much peace to the Jewish people. He was ruling in a way where wrongs were righted. It looked like it was kind of a law and order society. And I think some of that may have had some subtle hints. Because when he starts accusing Paul, does he say this fella is a guy who likes to promote peace, or this guy is like a fella who wants to stir things up and create rabble and trouble?
Trouble.
All right. Now, if you're complimenting the governor and say, it is through your reign, through your rule, through your policies, we have peace. And we're here today to talk about this fella who's living in what kind of way? He's tearing the place up. Are you kind of giving a hint to the governor as far as which way he should vote? This is good. We like peace. We appreciate you. But now here's a thorn in your side, Mr. Governor. And we brought him to you. You can take care of him. So how much he was trying to imply there is not clear, but at least perhaps a little of that. So even if the governor couldn't find Paul guilty of some other stuff, perhaps at least this charge could be made that Paul was disturbing the peace and thus undermining the efforts of the governor. As you look at verse 3, Felix is told, and again, this is really a lot of flowery speech that was not quite true, that he had helped the Jewish people in all ways and in all places. And when it came to thankfulness, they were most grateful because Felix was an excellent governor. So you have really here what we would think of as perhaps extreme flattery. He heaps this praise on Felix, but that's not uncommon. Going back to if you've ever been in a courtroom as a juror, when people talk about the judge, and maybe not so much him, but when they address the jury, how does the lawyer address the jury? Oh, I can see you don't have any sense. You know, I'm going to have a tough case because everybody here looks like a complete idiot. Well, you know, they don't talk that way, do they? How would the lawyer talk to and about the jury?
Graciously.
Yes. Graciously, they would seek to give compliments like what?
You're intelligent.
Okay, you are intelligent people, and you have the ability to sift through the facts in this case. You can see that the other guy is lying. What else might they say? Intelligence?
Honest.
All right, we believe that you're honest people. You're hardworking Americans. What else might they say? Honest? Intelligent? What about patience? What about, you know, you're a week into the trial and it's going to last a whole month, and the attorney says, you have been patient. You've been so good. And not only have you been patient, you've been willing to listen. I've seen that you've been attentive. So it's possible to go back and what Betty was talking about earlier, you're not only stroking the ego of the governor, it's possible to go in there and stroke the egos of the jury. You're wonderful people. You're the best jury I've had all year. Best jury I've ever had in 30 years of trial experience. You think those words might soak into the mind? And again, if the people think he's faking it, well, that probably may not hurt him too much in the end. But if there are some people on there, maybe just one person is all that's needed to swing that juror. So what we're seeing as far as some of the lawyer tricks in our day and time, you see those kinds of things here with this orator. All right, now here's one of the oddities. And you can just find some of these strange things. How many soldiers had been used to get Paul safely to Caesarea?
500.
All right, almost 500. You got 70 of those guys on horses. You've got 200 that were lightly armed, maybe with slingshots, some kind of armament. You've got the spearmen that he describes, and you've got 200 other combat troops. Now, if you are living in times which are truly peaceful, doesn't that seem a little excessive?
Yes.
So, I mean, on the one hand, he's saying, hey, yeah, things are great. Things are peaceful. Things are wonderful. Oh, but we just used 500 guys to bring this fella in. So it really doesn't match up very well. Now, he is definitely exaggerating, but there was a small amount of truth to what he said. There had been some revolts, and Felix had some success in ending them. There had been some robbers, some assassins, and he had helped put those down as well. He quelled some things like revolts, but still, the land was not exactly peaceful. So it would be like somebody who is hired to do 8 hours work, and they work 3 hours. Would you say it worked? Well, yeah, you know, he gave us 3 hours, but he didn't even give us half a day. So you can make an acknowledgement that there is, to some degree, success there. But as far as what he said about Felix, as far as the peace and how wonderful things were, that really was not true. Now, one other little historical note here that I found interesting, and perhaps you'll find it fascinating as well. It was possible for these orators, as they appeared before people like Felix, to not deal with any facts. It was possible for them to make their entire presentation on nothing but flattery. I find that frustrating. If I were the fellow who were being accused, you know, let's go and let's have a fact-based trial. I'm innocent, just bring out the facts. But this other fellow can just stand up there and neglect the facts and just make the governor or the jury feel good, and then I'm judged based on really pretty much feelings. When you look at this and you make some comparisons to our legal system, you sort of end up shaking your head and thinking, wow, we can really identify with what we have here in Acts chapter 24. There's some strong parallels or similarities. Anything you want to look at before we look at verses 4 through 6? Don, we'll start with you and then maybe Stan and possibly another. That's what most people suspect. We can't prove that one way or the other.
So that was smarter of the Jews to do that.
I would think so, for a couple of reasons. If you're going before this fella, you know, they are in a pagan court, so to speak. So you use one of the pagans for your defense lawyer. You know, this is probably not the best illustration, but there are some small communities often down south where it's kind of the Bubba network. You know, everybody's connected to everybody else in town. And if you are charged with something and you need a defense lawyer and you think, I'm going to get this high-powered lawyer from New York or California and bring him down here to Bubbaville, how do you think that's going to go over?
Not very well.
I mean, if you're really in a tight fix, it's better to go out and get who?
Bubba.
Yeah, you better go get Bubba. You better get the brother-in-law of the judge. Why? Because he understands the lay of the land, and he's kind of connected. So bringing in a Jewish orator, I do not believe, would have been a very effective choice. And the Jews wanted to win. So this would have been, I think, we know how the Jews regarded Gentiles. So here they show up, and, you know, they're all agreeing, as we get down a little further, they're all agreeing to what this guy said. So they're putting on a great show, but it just shows hypocrisy. But they're looking for every possible edge. So that was a great point to bring out, and I think you're exactly right. Stan?
Well, you mentioned, you used the phrase that this was approach was a lawyer's trick. It really is it's a trick of human nature.
Well, that's true.
We do this approach day in and day out, especially when it comes to something that is negative. We almost always approach, or should actually approach people with positives first, and then you go into whatever it is that's negative. And if we've just gotten through studying the book of Revelation, and there's a prime example, you know, when he's talking to the churches, I know your works, I know how you hated the Nicolaitans. He does exactly the same thing, but I've got something against you. That's exactly the same thing this guy was doing.
Yeah, a compliment, especially if it's, you know, can do a lot of good. But especially if it's delivered with sincerity. They can be very, very powerful. I was curious the other day. I saw a fella out in public. He had $3 clipped to his shirt. Now, I didn't have to know why that was there, but I was awfully curious. I mean, he's in a public spot. He's working in a restaurant. He's got $3 clipped to his shirt. Now, there could have been a couple of ways to ask that question that probably would not have been good. So I thought, how can I ask him? I thought, is he making change? So anyway, I came up with what I considered was a gracious remark. And he apparently considered that acceptable. He kind of laughed a little bit, and he said, it's my birthday. So people apparently had given him some money. So I don't know if he had clipped it on there because he was hoping to get more. We didn't quite get that far in the discussion. But that question could have been asked in some ways where I would have gotten a very bad reaction. I mean, none of your business or some smart aleck remark. But the right words, right tone, right way, right time gave me probably more information than I needed, and it was given freely. So you're right. Sometimes those words, good or bad, it can take you in two drastically different directions. And this fella, maybe it was a high profile case. He certainly must have realized that this was important for the Jews. And if they were willing to pay Judas 30 pieces of silver, I mean, getting rid of Paul, I guess you could potentially argue that Paul was an even greater thorn than Jesus, because Jesus was only around for about 3 years. And then when he finally picks up steam, I mean, they have to put up with him for a while. But I mean, Paul, it looks like he's young enough where he just keeps going and going and going. And the charges that they make, I mean, he's outside the area of Israel. I imagine that it was whatever we have to do to get this guy shut down, we'll take it and do it. Don, back to you.
Well, Jesus told us to treat everybody as our neighbor.
Sure.
And as Christians, that should be the first thing out of our mouth, even though yeah. we want to tear into this guy or gal. We ought to do that first. Because that's the way we want to be treated. We want to be softened up a little bit. Because everybody likes to be praised or something.
Yeah, but and a lot of this, especially for the younger folks on social media, the Bible says a soft answer turns away wrath, which is kind of what we're talking about here. I mean, you know, we're not talking about a compliment per se, but we are talking about you are trying to use the kindest speech that you can. Paul in Ephesians chapter 4 described it this way. He said, speaking the truth in love. So there are a lot of people when they speak, there's always a point at the end, so to speak, figuratively speaking, and they just, you know, want to jab it. They want to stick it to somebody. And you can make the point. You can speak the truth and not be hateful. I posted a little on Facebook last night. They were talking about a movie and, some same-sex stuff that was in the movie. And I said, you know, look, this is what the Bible teaches. And I had a couple of people said, let's make that shareable, because the way that it was presented was kind. Basically. So we want to stand for the truth. We have to stand for the truth. We have to speak the truth. But you don't have to be ugly about it. But there are some people who simply haven't learned that lesson yet. That it? Okay, let's go back and see what we've got in verses 4 through 6. But, now this is the orator still speaking, that I be not further tedious unto thee. That's just rich. I entreat thee to hear us of thy clemency a few words. For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of insurrections among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who moreover essayed to profane the temple, on whom also we laid hold. And then you find some funny stuff going on here, probably in your Bible translation. You might even be missing these words. And we would have judged him according to our law. So we have this overly flowery introduction, and the orator says, Governor, look, I know that you know you're busy and got other stuff to do, so what am I not going to do? I'm not going to burden you. I'm not going to tire you out. I'm not going to give a long speech. Now, there have been some guys who've been preachers who have done that. I'm not going to talk for very long. And 2 hours later, well, now that we're through with the introduction. No. That's not what he does here. When he says he's going to make it short, when he says he's going to be brief, that's exactly what he does. He says, I'm just going to use a few words. And if you'll just use your clemency, if you just indulge me, just give me a little longer. And sometimes we say that. I even say that sometimes. Just put that in the back burner. We'll get to it. Or you're just a step ahead of me. He calls Paul a pestilent fella, and he is a mover of insurrections among all the Jews in the world, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. All right, ancient Rome ruled in some ways kind of like America. When we have problems, let's say that there is, we've seen some shootings throughout the country. When there is a shooting, there's a stabbing. There have been a lot of those lately as well. Let's just use the image of a stabbing. When somebody is stabbed, maybe they die. Do they run that case up to the Supreme Court?
No.
Do they run that case down to the state capitol? No, they're not interested in that unless it's really unusual. What do they do?
Handle it local.
all right, they handle it locally. We've got the local police, and they'll go out, and we've got a local prosecutor. And unless this is really something unusual, you know, the guy's a mass killer or something, then we might engage the FBI if we're crossing state lines. But for the most part, we can handle this locally. That was kind of Rome's policy as well. We're going to give people local jurisdiction. They can go out and handle these crimes. They've got prosecutors. They've got courts. They've got judges. They have all of those things as well. Imperial Rome only got involved when it looked like there was a threat to the state, and our nation operates the same way. If it looks like there is a threat to America, here come the feds. And they're just going to show up maybe in the black helicopters, the black cars, and all that stuff. Or if you find, as you go back and you look at ancient Rome, you have local authorities battling with each other. They can't figure it out. You've got this one against that one. And sometimes you'll see that maybe even with a disaster. The Fed may send in some help or some support, or they may use some authority to make some kinds of decisions. All right, in this case, when you break it down, we really have three charges against the Apostle Paul from this orator. Number one, he says there is a personal charge. This Paul is a persistent man. He's a pest, and we're going to come back and say more about that. Number two, there is a political charge. What's a political charge? All right. He is stirring people up. He's a rabble-rouser. And we could maybe add to that that he's also the promoter of an illegal religion. More about that, too. And then number three, and he saves this one for the last, there's a doctrinal charge. Now, that probably didn't interest Rome too much, but if you want to make sure, if you've been to a court case, or if you've ever known somebody who was charged with a crime, the DA might start out with, we're going to charge you with 10 things. Well, that sounds really bad and scary, and it's obviously, yeah, it probably is. But after some time passes, the DA talks to you, or things get a little further down as far as a court hearing, what happens to those 10 charges?
Reduced.
All right, they're reduced down to maybe three or four. So sometimes you hear people talk about sometimes overcharging. They will go for this when really they should have gone down to this, or they will de-escalate the charge, those kinds of things. And here we have a doctrinal charge that Paul had profaned the temple. Now let's go back and talk about Paul being a pest. And then the charge of him creating insurrection among all the Jews throughout all the world. The Romans, the Pax Romania, Pax Romana. Anybody know what that is? Roman peace. The Romans were big on peace. They kind of ruled the world, and they wanted peace. They wanted safety. They wanted things to, you know, just kind of keep going along well. America has been like that for a long time. We've kind of gotten away from that the last few years. But people, you know, previous generations able to live in their house and didn't have to lock the door at night. I mean, they wanted to, you know, live in an area where they could walk safely down the streets. I mean, we want a safe country. At least I think that's what most people want, and that's what Romans wanted. If that is your philosophy as a country, as a nation, as an empire, we're going to have peace, and we will use the military to enforce that peace. I mean, if we've got to send out troops and some people have to be, you know, beaten on with sticks, if we have to take some lives, if we have to kill some people, perhaps even by crucifixion, we are going to have peace. All right, if that's your philosophy, and you have somebody who's coming in, remember when we started talking about Paul and the Jewish mob? Do you remember the Egyptian that Lysias thought that Paul was? You remember that? They, you know, had to kind of show up, and we're out after those guys, the assassins. So we can't have that. That's not the way of Rome. So if you're able to come before the governor and you say there is someone who is disrupting the peace, and it's not over here in this little town, it's not this local issue, where's he doing it? Throughout all the world. You think as the governor, I mean, you've got a pretty high, and you're not the Caesar, you're not that high as far as a food chain, but if you've got somebody who's doing that, and this person is brought before you, and you don't take care of the matter, then guess what? Whoever is on the throne of Rome is probably going to hear about it, and it's going to be lights out for you. If you're not killed in a very brutal way, you're probably at least going to lose your job and maybe like the Apostle John, be banished somewhere that's not a very pleasant spot. They'll put you out in some rock and maybe forget to come back for you or forget to feed you. So this idea that Paul was creating insurrection throughout all the world, it was very, very serious. Now, tied in with that is the second point. If you're going to have that peace, what's helpful? And I'll ask the question in a different way. If you have a group of people who are different, they're different, maybe different races, or different in ages, or different in interests, How do you bond them together?
Through their faith.
Okay, there has to be something. It would be like having two pieces of wood. I have a piece over here, I have a piece over here, and they're separate. But I need something to bring them together. So we need what? We need... Well, with our wood. Well, all right, we need some kind of adhesive. It might be glue, it might be something similar to that, but we need something that's going to bond them together. And in this particular case, faith will sometimes bond people together. The Romans understood that. And what faith did the Romans use to bond people together?
Caesar.
Yes, and all other gods. We are a God-fearing people. Now, your God may not be my God. You know, your God might control the sun. My God, in my mind, might control the moon. Your God controls the sea. But we're going to worship these gods, and Caesar is Lord. Caesar is God. So if you've got this system, it works. You know, everybody's kind of, you know, doing the same thing. We're all going to, you know, pinch incense to Caesar once a year. We're going to say that Caesar is God, Caesar is Lord, and you've got your God that you worship. We've got our God, and the worship, I don't know that it really, I mean, a lot of it was sexual. But, you know, you're paying your money, you're going to the temples, and you're fornicating and those kinds of things, and everybody's happy, so to speak. Well, then the Christians start showing up, and they start saying what? Caesar is not Lord. Uh-oh. And what you're doing at the temple, that's a sin. And all these gods that you have, they're idols. There's nothing there. Now, if you've got one guy starting to teach that kind of stuff, how serious is that? Is that going to get your attention as far as the governor, the local people? It is. And that can make it all the way up to the Caesar, because you are threatening the empire. So when Tertius comes, when this orator is making his case, that's really the bottom line. That's the heart. He is saying this fella is a threat to the Roman Empire. And if you're going to be brought up on charges in the ancient world, this is about as bad as it got. Now, here is one of the interesting things that I was mentioning that I was going to get to. The word translated pest or pestilence actually describes a plague. When this guy appears before Felix, he's essentially saying Paul is not just an annoyance. He's saying Paul is like a plague. In this particular case, you might say he was like a moral plague. But imagine being called a plague. Imagine being put in a position where you're appearing before a judge, and the person is saying, look, you are a moral plague among the people. And then they amplify that a little bit. They use the word discord. They use the word insurrection. One source defined that as a societal sickness. We've just gone through COVID for a couple of years. And imagine somebody saying, you know, this is the spreader of COVID-19. If you trace that back to a single person, how would that individual be treated?
Yeah.
Well, I think that, yeah, they'd not be treated well, but how else? You just going to let him roam in society?
He'd be isolated.
All right, you know, we have to deal with this person. Let's confine them. Let's isolate them. They cannot be out in public. And that's really what Tertius is trying to say about Saul. He is the one who is responsible for political unrest. Now, that's not true. When you go back to Acts chapter 21, Acts chapter 22, you find that it was those Jews. And the other thing here, this kind of goes back to the point that Don was making a little earlier. If Tertius is indeed a Gentile, and you have these Jews who are appearing before Felix, who's everybody trying to nail to the wall? That's not a hard question. Who's the guy on trial?
Paul.
It's Paul. All right, Paul, Jew or Gentile? He's a Jew. So here you have these Jews using, we assume, this Gentile prosecutor to say what? We have one of our own. We have a fellow Jew. And we recognize that he's doing what to the Roman Empire? He's trying to bring it down. He's trying to destroy it. Whatever Rome is trying, how good does that make the Jews look? Well, I would think pretty good. Because, you know, if you're there to complain about a Gentile, governor's probably thinking, hey, you know, we've heard this song and dance before. But you're bringing us one of your own. So, that also may have been, as far as the impression that was left on Felix, something that was very, very powerful. Anything that you want to add or ask before we say a few more things? Don?
Talented lawyer, everything is based upon what Paul disagreed with the Jews. In not with Rome,
yeah,
not with any Gentile, just a Jew. And according to what I read, Felix was not a nice man.
Correct.
And he could care less about the Jews. So here's the lawyer that's trying to do everything based upon the Jews being disrupted by this man. And he probably doesn't care.
Yeah.
And also, he probably knew that Paul was a citizen of Rome. So that would make a difference. So I don't know. This guy, these Jews were dead on sight, really.
It's like some other people. There's an old joke among preachers on his sermon outline, weak point, bang the podium. Now, I've thought about that a lot of times over the years, not that I want to have a bunch of weak points, but sometimes when a person does not have a good defense, they have poor arguments, then they begin to shout and react in maybe not irrational ways, but they begin to put the focus more on emotion. They kind of distract you with this because they're not well equipped over here. When you look at Acts chapter 23 and verse 29, going back there just a little bit, you have this commander, this captain, writing a letter to Felix, and in 29 he says, whom I found to be accused about what? Questions of the law. And it says, you know, nothing is in his record as far as being worthy of death, nothing worthy of bonds. We also see that. But I find that interesting to point out that here he's investigated fairly thoroughly, as much as he can, and he says the questions are all about their law. It's Jewish stuff, which Felix would not have been any stranger to that kind of thing. I mean, it would have seemed like the Jews are always hollering about. And we can see that today. If we talk to people about, you know, women preachers, if we talk to them about instrumental music and worship, a lot of people, especially out there in the religious world, or the non-religious world, both, how do they see that? Huh? You know, you're stuck in the Stone Ages. Who cares if there's an organ? Now, I'm not saying that, but I'm telling you that's how a lot of people would read. You know, woman, she's probably more qualified than men. Why not have? You've got a shortage of preachers. Just bring in the women. There are people, when it comes to religious things, they just don't see those as significant matters. And if you're the Romans, you've got a lot of other stuff that you're worrying about. You know, we've got people to care for. We've got to make sure that they've got water, collect the taxes, make sure that we've got good roads, and we need to make sure that the peace is being kept. Who cares about the religious disputes of the Jews? So I think you're exactly right, and that helps further explain why this orator has to come in with guns blazing and has to say some things that really get the attention of the governor. So let's start with some flattery, and then let's go after charges like insurrection.
Well, I think you hit on it. What he's going to be concerned about more than anything is the fact that Paul's being accused of creating insurrection. Maybe he doesn't care about Jewish law, et cetera, et cetera. But hey, this man is a Jew, and it's within this sect that I'm having a problem, and that problem is insurrection. I've got to do something.
Yes, so he's kind of taking it out of the religious realm and trying to put it into the political realm. Notice, too, this little point. This is a fine point, but it is a significant point. How is Paul described when the word ringleader comes up? Well, I think it's a little after that. Let's go back and read the ringleader part again.
Ringleader.
No, just a little bit before that.
Throughout the world.
Creator of distinction among all the Jews throughout the world. And a ringleader.
Okay, there you go. The last two words that you said. What comes before ringleader?
And.
Anything else?
A.
He is a ringleader. Now, what would have happened if this order would have said, he is the ringleader? Which is an easier charge to prove? He is the robber, he is an A robber. Or he is a robber. It's the A, because if you say he is the one, then what are you doing? You have put all of your cards on the table. And if you can't prove that he is the number one leading chief ringleader, what have you done to your case? You may not have sunk it, but you've definitely got a lot of holes in it. But what happens if you just say he is a ringleader? That's a lot easier to prove, isn't it? There are several out there, but this guy is definitely one of the main ones. Okay, That's a whole lot easier to consider. And I think when you look at the skill of this fellow here in Acts chapter 24, it helps show that very, very well. All right, when you look at the word which is translated ringleader, it was a military word. It described one who was first in an army, a standard bearer, a leader, a commander. So we would certainly agree with the fact that Paul was a principal leader when it came to sharing the gospel. If you have the facts on your side, whether this is a discussion with someone or you are dealing with a court trial, where do you want to put those facts? Do you want to put them at the beginning? Do you want to put them at the end? Do you want to put them in the middle or somewhere else?
Beginning.
You want to put them at the beginning. You want to tell people, and if you've ever been in a court trial, you hear the fella say, look, we've got the video, and we've got witnesses, and, you know, we've got a body. You know, these are the facts, and these are going to be the, in the opening statements, these are going to be the things that you're going to be shown. This is the evidence that we have. And then the other guy, assuming that all those things are true, the other guy, as far as a defense attorney, he's probably going to stand up and say what?
They're all lies.
They're all lies. Well, he does have video, but what's true of it? It's been doctored. And we do have this and that, but there are problems with this. He begins to go ahead and try to shoot holes in the claims. But the Jewish orator only spent about half his time in the facts, and then even what he does say was somewhat general. All the Jews in the world. Well, that sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? Today, we see this a lot with politicians. Someone says, for example, especially in dealing with young people, if we don't get this bill passed, if we don't get this money, then people are going to suffer. They're going to be marginalized, or they're going to be this and that. Well, that sounds really bad. But if you step back and you say, well, what does that mean? How is the person going to be marginalized? How are the people going to be discriminated against? I mean, that very well could be true. But don't leave us with those generalities. It would be like saying, if you do this, a lot of people are going to be unhappy. Well, that sounds bad, but what does that mean? They use other words like disenfranchise. Someone says, well, that's not fair. Well, again, maybe it's not, but go ahead and expound on that a little bit. Make that clear. But people, especially attorneys, they've been really, really good as far as making general statements, and people come away with an impression, but if they thought about that a little more critically, they would see things slightly differently. All right, normally the Jews and their religious matters were not of too much interest to the Romans, but Rome did have some rules. And one of the rules involved new religions. If you were one of the old standard religions, you want to worship some pagan god, it really doesn't matter which one, we're good with that. But if you start bringing in some new religions, then what? We have a problem. Now, for a long time, Christianity was acceptable to the Romans because the Romans simply saw that Christianity was an aspect of Judaism. Not really an offshoot, per se, but they were connected. They were basically in the same family. Teresa wanted a lily the other day, and I'm not much of a lily person. So, I mean, I thought of this lily, that lily, but apparently, you know, she kind of wanted the specific one. You know, it just can't be in the family, so to speak. But this one, for a while, they thought it was close enough, so they used the word sect. They thought that Christianity was a sect. And that implied that Paul was part of some cultic, some bizarre group, which had violated Roman law. So, it was kind of tough.